With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Sabrina Halvorsen.
Good morning, and thank you for joining us today on the AgNet News Hour. Coming up later, there's a positive outlook for tree nuts with increased export projections. And we're watching concerns about a continued HPAI outbreak. But our top story today, there are two big topics on the minds of growers regarding ag policy, says Brian Keel, Director of Government and Public Affairs with the ag business advisory company, Pinion. One, he says, is the Farm Bill, and the other, taxes.
There is a tax bill that has passed the House of Representatives by a big bipartisan majority, and it has some really good provisions for farmers. It takes bonus depreciation back up to 100%. It has other tax provisions that a lot of farmers use. So in 2017, Congress passed the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, which was a big tax relief bill back then. Unfortunately, a lot of those provisions are expiring, and they're starting to phase out now, and then they'll really phase out in 25 and 26. So, for example, one of the issues we're spending a lot of time thinking about and talking to our clients about is estate planning. The 2017 bill doubled the estate exemption and the gift tax exemptions so that people can really give away a lot of money during their life and not have Uncle Sam grab a big chunk. Those provisions go back to the original levels in 2025 and 2026. So those are things people need to get on top of and stay on top of. This tax bill doesn't address specifically the estate and gift tax issues, but it does address bonus depreciation, which if you are buying equipment is a really big deal. How quickly can you depreciate equipment? So we want to see this provision pass. Unfortunately, the Senate has stalled, and it's frustrating because the House, again, it was bipartisan. I mean, it was a blowout vote. Democrats and Republicans voted for it. The basic deal was there are business tax provisions that a lot of the Republicans like, and there are child tax credits that a lot of the Democrats like. So it kind of brought together this great coalition to get the bill passed. We're hopeful the Senate will pass it, but so far they've just been sitting on it for a month now, and we're frustrated because at some point we're too far into an election year and it won't pass. So if people care about taxes and want to see your taxes lowered, next time you're talking to your senator, ask him to get that bill moving.
A new report can help farmers analyze their crop risks and opportunities. Michael Clements reports.
Pattern Ag uses analytics to help farmers optimize their spending on crop protection, seed selection, and fertility inputs while improving the long-term productivity of their land. Danielle Watts, VP of Data, Pattern Ag, says the 2024 Predictive Ag Report is backed by a large amount of data.
We analyzed more than 200 billion genetic reads from soil samples taken across the Midwest, and they form a soil metagenomics database, which is the world's largest soil metagenomic database. We put all of that information together and package that into our predictive ag report. One of the key ways in which we really drive our understanding of what's happening in these fields is through a large research program we have. It's called the Pattern Ag Growers Initiative, where we're working directly with commercial growers to understand the impacts of their field management on the soil biology, as well as what sort of links there are between the soil biology and their yield outcome.
The Soil Productivity Index provides benchmarks of yield potential for farmers to compare their fields against.
So what we've done is taken years of grower information, including yield, as well as all of their soil biology and chemistry, and put that together in a way that really helps explain how far off are you from the potential yields that you could be getting. Are you pretty much maximizing out the yield through your management practices of the soil in your farm, or are there opportunities for you to dive in a level deeper and really increase your soil productivity potential?
The report can help growers make crop input decisions for the growing season.
We produce an almanac every year where we're pinpointing the regions with the highest risk of pest and pathogen outbreaks. And these are really detailed maps that are going to look at pathogens as well as what sort of upcoming risks we're seeing in terms of biofertility. And then diving a layer deeper this year, we've also released a bunch of foliar insights. So where are we seeing regions of high foliar pathogen loads? We're also providing a lot of insights about where we're seeing significant yield differences based on the pathogen loads in the field. So this year is a sort of new release around that where we're able to say, here's where we're seeing significant yield losses.
This is the second year that Pattern Ag has published the Predictive Ag Report. Watts offers an example of what growers can expect.
We saw something really interesting going on in north central Iowa in particular, where we were seeing between 30 and 80 bushels per acre lower corn in fields that were really high risk for fusarium root rot, northern corn leaf blight, tar spot, and anthracnose of corn. Since the average yield for corn in this region is around 200 bushels per acre, our growers in that region where we saw low fusarium, they were upwards around 240 bushels per acre. And in contrast, fields really high in fusarium were averaging about 150 bushels per acre in 2023. What that tells us is that there's a really significant opportunity to be a little bit more aggressive in the management of some of these root rots to achieve that top end yield that's possible in that region.
Copies of the 2024 Predictive Ag Report can be downloaded online at www.pattern.ag. Michael Clements reporting.
This is the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. We will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news. You're listening to the AgNet NewsHour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. In today's National Spotlight, five projects are selected to advance for consideration for funding under USDA's Powering Affordable Clean Energy Program. Rod Bain has more.
Picking up the pace regarding investments in clean energy projects. PACE, in acronym form, representing USDA's Powering Affordable Clean Energy Program. And according to Rural Development Rural Utilities Service Administrator Andy Burke,
Arizona, Colorado, Hawaii, and Nebraska, these are the different places that have been selected to go to the next awards phase.
Five projects total are being considered for a sum of $139 million in funding, with projects ranging from expanding battery energy storage system capacity to financing solar renewable energy resource facilities.
We're going to start working on the environmental reviews and getting these projects to where they can be completed. We want to make sure that we're not only completing these projects, getting the clean energy up and running, but also doing it in a way that is affordable for the communities.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
A write-up from the U.S. Department of Agriculture talks about the booming trade over the last 100 years and what to look for in the future. David Geiger has more.
In the latest USDA Ag Export Forecast, a stronger dollar and competition are the two primary reasons for U.S. Ag export expectations declining to $170.5 billion, well below the 2022 amount of more than $196 billion. Meanwhile, ag imports are set in 2024 to increase by $5.5 billion to $201 billion, setting the country up for more than a $30 billion ag trade deficit.
But I think bringing some context to what is in those numbers is really important. Some of the largest growth of imports that we've seen is actually products like distilled spirits, things like tequila.
Going back to that tequila statistic, she says the U.S. consumes more tequila by volume than anywhere in the world, including Mexico. It also is a new addition. In 2021, the USDA adopted the World Trade Organization's definition of agricultural products, including distilled spirits. Additionally, half the value of U.S. agricultural imports are in horticulture products. Taylor says that would be year-round produce in the grocery store.
As you look into some of the numbers of our imports, they are products that are non-competitive, that we don't produce. Think things like bananas and pineapple and coconuts, things that are maybe counter-seasonal. So blueberries in January, which are good for our consumers, are also good for our industry to keep year-round demand of blueberries.
These items can also support local food manufacturing and rural communities, Taylor says. And another reason the deficit needs context, economic trends have been good.
The United States has recovered better than anyone and certainly better than projected from the COVID pandemic. We have a very strong U.S. dollar. Incomes are rising, so people have more money. And so we are a demanding kind of voracious consumer base here in the United States, which people want to access and tap into.
Still, as consumers get the diversified markets they want, Taylor says that does not give any excuses to stop selling U.S. farm. She points to the new Regional Agriculture Promotion Program, among other projects and trade missions, aimed to break into new foreign markets.
So our producers, our exporters, and our agribusinesses have the opportunity to expand. And so I really think there's two sides to that coin, and we need to be focused on that export side, opening new markets, knocking down barriers, and that's exactly what we're trying to do here at USDA.
I'm David Geiger reporting.
That's today's National Spotlight. Now here's Will Jordan with this livestock report.
In today's livestock news, stronger rules and strengthened enforcement. Those are the key tenets of the new Packers and Stockyards rules. United States Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack shares more.
The president has repeatedly said that fair and competitive markets have been a cornerstone of the American economy and need to remain so. That's why we at USDA are committed at the president's instructions and direction to issue stronger and newer rules under the Packers and Stockyards Act to provide greater clarity and strengthen enforcement under the act. In the latest major milestone towards achieving this goal, I'm pleased to say that we'll be announcing the final rule, which we refer to as the Inclusive Competition and Market Integrity under the Packers and Stockyards Act rule. This is going to help producers and growers who have become increasingly vulnerable to a range of practices that unjustly exclude them from economic opportunity and disadvantage them and undermine market integrity in the livestock and poultry industry.
Yet these rules follow action already taken by the department.
It adds to the significant action USDA has already taken in this space, issuing the landmark transparency in poultry growing contracting tournament final rule, also working with 33 attorney generals in the Agricultural Competitive Partnership Initiative to focus on what's happening at the state level. The contract cattle contract library, which provides greater transparency, committing nearly $1 billion to expanding meat and poultry processing, all of which designed to encourage more competition, as well as enhancing our laboring rules to avoid misrepresentation.
National Cattlemen's Beef Association Vice President of Government Affairs Ethan Lane issued a statement following the release of the U.S. Department of Agriculture's latest Packers and Stockyards rule. He said, NCBA's concern with this regulation has always been based in the rule's unforeseen impacts to standard business practices. We have remained consistently opposed to any discriminatory practices in the marketplace. While we still have concerns about the unintended consequences of the rule, we are pleased that USDA has addressed most of our significant concerns between the proposed and final rules. We continue to urge USDA to ensure this rule remains focused on its stated objective, with which we wholeheartedly agree, and does not stray into extraneous, unrelated subject matter discussed in the proposal's preamble. That's a quote from National Cattlemen's Beef Association Vice President of Government Affairs, Ethan Lane. In other livestock news, the American Lamb Board is allocating funds through the Cooperative Funding Program for local sheep producer groups, lamb suppliers, and direct marketers to cost-share marketing efforts that align with ALB's mission to grow awareness and demand for American lamb. Applications can be submitted now until April 30th. Once application process closes, no additional application will be reviewed until October 1st. For the Cooperative Funding Program, ALB will prioritize funding opportunities designed to build consumer demand for American lamb by targeting consumers, chefs, retailers, and other non-industry audiences. I'm Will Jordan for AgNet West.
This is the AgNet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson, and we will be back in just a moment. Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Coming up in a few moments, we'll have today's This Land of Ours report, but first, more of the day's agriculture news. And with today's AgNet West headlines, here's AgNet West Farm News Director, Brian German.
The North American Agribusiness Review from Rabobank's Rabo Research Food and Agribusiness team shows a positive outlook for tree nuts. Senior analyst for Rabo Agrifinance, David Magana, said that exports have maintained a strong pace.
We see increases in exports year to date of double digits year on year for almonds, pistachios, walnuts, and pecans as well. Particularly for pistachios, through December, exports were up 102% year on year, with significant increases in exports to China. So last year, exports to China were about 80 million pounds, and this year, those were over 200 million pounds during the first 4 months of the marketing season. So the industry is doing a good job to put the pistachios in the destination market in time for the Chinese New Year, which is the biggest demand pool of the year.
Syngenta Crop Protection and Levy Bio, a subsidiary of Evigene, have formed a partnership to discover and develop new biological solutions. Levy Bio's technology will identify and optimize bioinsecticide candidates combined with Syngenta's global research and commercialization capabilities. Representatives from both companies expressed enthusiasm for the strategic partnership with goals of introducing innovative modes of action. Insect damage costs the global economy an estimated $70 billion annually, a figure expected to rise due to factors like climate change and insecticide resistance. Syngenta aims to combat these challenges through sustainable agriculture, collaborating with innovative companies like Levy Bio to diversify and accelerate innovation. LevyBio's computational capabilities will complement Syngenta's experience in product development, aligning with both companies' commitment to sustainable farming. The Securities and Exchange Commission responded to concerns from the farming community and removed the Scope 3 reporting requirements from its final climate disclosure rule. The rule, which would have mandated greenhouse gas emissions reporting for supply chains, prompted significant opposition from agricultural organizations due to potential privacy issues and financial strain on small farms. The American Farm Bureau Federation had led efforts to eliminate Scope 3 from the requirements and praised the decision from the Securities and Exchange Commission. While being supported by ag organizations, the disclosure rule has received significant criticism from several environmental groups. The finalized rules also reduce reporting requirements for Scopes 1 and 2 emissions. AFBF is also encouraging California to withdraw its Scope 3 reporting requirement, as the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and others have recently challenged the state law and its national implications. An ongoing outbreak of cases of highly pathogenic avian influenza among wild birds continues to be a concern. USDA Chief Veterinarian Rosemary Sifford said it's important to stay vigilant with biosecurity measures.
We are still seeing detections in the wild birds. While the numbers are lower, they're still there. And so I would expect that as long as the migration comes back, at this point it seems like they're going to be carrying the virus. So I think we should be prepared for that as we move into the spring. There's a lot of work going on around what's going on with this virus and how is it persisting in the wild birds. Hopefully we'll learn more from that work and be able to use that to inform our procedures. I think we've seen our surges and we've seen the troughs over the last couple of years. In the October, November, early December timeframe, we saw another surge. We are still very consistently seeing that the surges are associated mostly with direct introductions from wild birds, and it's when you have wild birds in your neighborhood. But we do have to really keep our watch up. I think in some cases we're seeing a little bit of fatigue, and we're all tired of this now. But it's really, really important that we keep the message up that biosecurity is still supremely important, particularly if there are wild birds in your neighborhood.
Applications are now being accepted for the Proven Winners Horticulture Scholarship Program. Proven Winners wants to assist and recognize the academic talent that exists across North America by presenting scholarships to students in both four-year universities as well as community colleges and vocational schools. The Plant Breeding Scholarship is available for students who are committed to developing new and exciting plants in this competitive market. The Innovations in Horticultural Marketing Scholarship is available for students with not only a passion for plants, but also for knowing how to market and sell them. Finally, the Grower Excellence Scholarship is meant to support the next generation of great plantsmen and women pursuing careers in plant production. Applications for the three $5,000 scholarships are due by April 15th. More information about the scholarship opportunities is available at provenwinners.com/scholarship.
New investments in clean energy, that's coming up on This Land of Ours. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack this week announced $2.3 billion in projects to expand clean power in rural communities. USDA is moving forward on clean energy investments in 23 states to reduce pollution and strengthen rural America's power grid. The announcement includes the first five awards, totaling $139 million under the Powering Affordable Clean Energy Program. Secretary Vilsack also announced $2.2 billion in funding toward 39 projects to help ensure more than 2 million people in rural areas have access to reliable electricity. Vilsack says rural electric cooperatives are the backbone of America's power delivery in San Antonio, Texas. American Farm Bureau Federation President Zippy Duval responded, "Building new markets for commodities is difficult work, and we are glad USDA is listening to participants and continuing to be nimble in implementing this program." This is the AgNet News Hour. We will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news. Welcome back. We have now this week's Fungicide Management Minute, brought to you by Corteva. I'm talking with Corteva's Daniel Abruzzini.
Daniel, let's talk about preventive care. Why should growers apply fungicides preventively, you know, prior to disease development?
Yeah, you know, and there's a lot of products that are on the market today that, you know, claim, you know, some reach back control, but always being preventative, you know, get out into the field and scouting and being aware of conditions, you know, diseases that might be coming up if there's a rain event coming up, and getting that protection on early allows those fungicides to work so much better, allows them to actually, you know, be more preventative and prevent things from getting going. And, you know, it really is the best way to apply fungicides. And so you know, being on a preventative plan is the best bet for success during the season. If you're trying to play catch up the whole year, I think you're going to have a big headache. And so it's just always a lot better to be on the preventative side when looking at disease control.
So is that even more important with select varieties that have resistance to common diseases?
Yes. And so, you know, I mean, I would say when you're looking at, you know, certain varieties that have resistance, it's even, you know, very important as well, because you need to be aware of like, hey, you know, what's this plant going to be susceptible to and what it has resistance to. And so, you know, so picking products, or can we start over on that one? Sorry.
Yeah. And I think like,
can you repeat that question?
Sure.
You're saying resistance, right?
Yeah. And it was worded kind of weird. So that was my issue.
Okay.
I just kind of read it
That's
off
okay.
of here, and I think they wrote it kind of weird. But so is that even more important with the varieties that have resistance issues?
No, absolutely. And so, you know, areas that have resistance, it can be a major issue. And so, you know, you need to know the frat groups that maybe potentially have resistance and combat them with maybe an alternate frat group or do proper rotation. And so to try to, you know, fight that resistance and try to, you know, not give it, you know, strengthen the problem, I guess, or create more resistance. So just frat group rotation and being preventative, I think it's going to be your best bet of fighting resistance.
So again, we're hearing about frat group rotation to help prevent resistance. That must be a key component to the plan.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I think throughout the season, you need to be consistently looking at your frat groups and being aware of what you're applying, you know, because they all have their strengths and, you know, and it should be all applied at certain times. So I think, you know, that's probably one of the most important things that you can look at is frat group rotation for a good season-long, you know, disease program.
So what are some of the things that Corteva offers that would be, a you know, good in this type of a plan for preventive care?
Yeah, you know, right now we have, you know, three main fungicides. Actually, we have four. So if you're looking at primarily tree nuts, we're going to have Indar, which is a frat group three. We have Fontellus, which is a seven. And then we have Approach that's out now and is a frat group 11. And then we also have Rally and Wine Grapes. That's another, group three as well. So, and, you know, we're excited down the road. We're expecting another fungicide to come out in potentially 2026, and that'll actually be a new frat group. So it'll be really nice to rotate with these existing frat group members as well.
Great. And for more information for growers, and for growers who would like more information, where can they find that?
Yeah, you know, actually, so we have a website you can go to. It's corteva.us/fungicide-resistance. And you can go there to find more information on any of the products that we talked about today.
That's this week's Fungicide Management Minute brought to you by Corteva. You can find that again on our website, agnetwest.com. Now here's Cindy Zimmerman.
Speaking with Brian Jennings, the CEO of the American Coalition for Ethanol. And Brian, you're going to Washington, and you're going to be talking about a lot of different things. So talk about what your agenda is for your fly-in.
Yeah, so our fly-in is on the 14th and the 15th of March. We're really looking forward to it. Some topics are going to be the same as they were in the past because, as you indicated, Cindy, we haven't sort of put some of these issues to bed. So on the very top of the list is E15 year-round. And, you know, it's frustrating that we continue to see some of the delays that we have from the Biden administration on the governor's petition. If 2025 is the year for those eight states, it's 2 or 3 years later than what the law required of EPA. I suppose it's, you know, better than never getting it. But we've got to see some more serious action on the part of EPA on that very subject. Now, the secretary also alluded to the possibility, or he even sort of made it sound like it was a likelihood, that we could get the temporary emergency-type waivers for the summer of 2024 as we did in 2022 and 2023. That would be huge. That would be very important. And so we're going to be pressing EPA to get the governor's petition done. We're going to be pressing EPA, if they are going to kick the can down the road, to do these emergency waivers for the summer. And then ultimately, Cindy, we're there to meet mostly with members of Congress, as you know, and so we'll be pressing for the bipartisan legislation that's pending. And, you know, we think we're getting closer and closer to a point where, you know, that's going to get adopted, but we have to continue to mobilize support for that. So E15 is going to be really the priority topic, honestly, at the fly-in. We're going to talk about climate smart agriculture and bills like the Next Generation Fuels Act, but E15 is really the timely, urgent topic right now.
Well, what about tailpipe emission standards? We're expecting that anytime.
I would say on the tailpipe rule, we do expect EPA to sort of backtrack a bit. It was always unreasonable and impractical to think that two-thirds of all vehicles could be battery electric only by 2032. That's an outrageously aggressive timeline. And so naturally, they're going to have to back off on that. And frankly, they're still going to find themselves, I think, in litigation when a final rule is issued this spring. I think that issue is going to sort of linger for a while in the courts. When it comes to the GREET model, I've heard so many rumors, good and bad, about what this new SAF version of GREET is going to look like. I don't know what to make of it. I'm gravely concerned about some intel that we've picked up on that EPA and others in this interagency working group want to dramatically increase land use change penalties for corn ethanol. On the other hand, we do know that there are, and Secretary Vilsack confirmed this, the GREET already allows for some sort of basic climate smart ag carbon credits. They're not quite as ambitious as we'd like to see, but I think that'll be a good starting point, and I do feel reasonably confident that this version of the GREET model adopted for the SAF tax credit is going to allow for, understand a cover crop can reduce soil carbon or increase soil carbon sequestration, as can reduce tillage. Nitrous oxide emissions can be reduced from fertilizer use. I think some of those things are going to be reflected in this that are going to be beneficial to us as well.
Well, regarding legislation, also the Flex Fuel Fairness Bill we'll be talking about, I assume, next month.
We are. I'm glad you mentioned that. So two bills in particular we're going to push, the Next Generation Fuels Act, and we look at that as a much more common sense approach to how vehicles should look in the future versus EPA's sort of, very arbitrary tailpipe rule. And so we're going to push the Next Generation Fuels Act as kind of a counter-programming to EPA's dangerous tailpipe rule. And then the Flex Fuel Fairness Act is just another sort of way to have a more balanced approach in the future, recognizing that we're going to have liquid fuels for decades to come, billions and billions of gallons of liquid fuels. Let's take advantage of low-carbon ethanol, and by golly, let's get more of these vehicles on the road that can use E85.
All right, thank you very much. Brian Jennings with the American Coalition for Ethanol.
This is the AgNet News Hour. We will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news. Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour. Now here's Chuck Zimmerman with today's featured interview.
I'm visiting with Eric Boyk at the Syngenta booth at Commodity Classic. And Eric, great to see you. Tell me a little bit about what's top of mind right now for Syngenta seeds here in North America.
Yeah, what's top of mind for me, as always, is farmers. And in particular, ag economy is changing. And so we're really pointing our team at how do we help farmers be profitable and strive to get a good return on their investment and drive a really, really significant improvement in their yields. That is obviously the top line of their profitability equation. So making sure we're partnering with farmers, as always, to do the right thing.
With Syngenta Seeds, you cover a broad range of brands, NK, Golden Harvest, GHX. How would you describe the changes that you've seen with Syngenta as it's grown some of its R&D and innovation products?
The beauty of what we are doing at Syngenta Seeds is if you've met one farmer, you've met one farmer. Meaning every farmer is unique to who they are. And when we think about the NK brand, for example, NK is sold exclusively through the retail channel. And those farmers really like to have a experience buying from retail where they can buy all their inputs from one location. Whereas our GHX route to market is really thinking about farmers that are multi-generational. So think about grandpa, dad, and grandson, like I grew up on our farm that way, where you have multi-generations of farmers farming together. And actually, those farmers are about 55% of all the output in agriculture right now. So they have somebody who's a landowner, somebody who's digitally oriented, somebody who's really after maximizing their profitability through an advisor. And that's what the GHX model does for us. And then we actually have our Greenleaf licensing model that serves independent seed companies in the marketplace as well to provide good genetics and good traits. And as many people know, there's not very many genetics and trait providers in the industry. So Syngenta, as a choice for independent seed companies, is ultimately a choice for farmers to help drive competition.
So we're at a record number of growers here for Commodity Classic. What do you want them to take away from Syngenta Seeds that they should walk away with?
Yeah, I think Syngenta Seeds is a really good partner for farmers. We are a company that can help them drive their productivity and drive their bottom line through our genetics and our traits. And even if you're not a row crop farmer, if you're a livestock farmer, we have our Inogen feed portfolio to really drive feed efficiency, drive and help actually market to consumers as well with a product that produces less CO2, less emissions into the air, less waste out of the animal, more milk, more beef from the animal through that feed. So we can be a really strong partner, and we complement that actually with our seed care products, our Cruiser Max Apex seed treatment, our industry-renowned portfolio of herbicides and fungicides and insecticides that go with it. So we can be that complete solution for farmers to help them drive their profitability.
How about from the standpoint of sustainability? I know Syngenta's got a sustainability plan. Tell us a little bit about that.
You know, we get a lot more questions in the past couple years versus the prior 5 years or so around sustainability. The conversations I've been in are about, you know, carbon indexing scoring with industry associations, but also larger farmers, progressive farmers that are really interested in lowering their carbon score so that they can take advantage of some of the premium opportunities. And then market to a changing consumer who's going to put more value on carbon. That's going back to Inogen Feed. That's what we are really excited about with Inogen Feed, is the ability to help a dairy producer or help a livestock or a cattle producer be able to maximize their profitability, but also market their crop, their product, their milk or their beef in a way that's carbon friendly to a consumer.
Well, something that definitely comes up is foreign ownership of land. It comes up. How does Syngenta fit into that sort of political football that we got going?
Political football is not necessarily fun, but, you know, we really think as a foreign-owned company, we believe, and there's many agricultural foreign-owned companies, but we really believe that the best place to start is what's best for the farmer. And what's best for the farmer is competition and choice. And if we work back from there, then that allows us to work with the industry associations and the governing bodies to find the right level of regulation. And we believe, for example, that a really strong CFIUS, which monitors all foreign land purchases, is important because that allows us to do business in the right way for farmers.
Before we close, what else would you want folks to know about what you're doing with Syngenta Seeds that we didn't touch on?
Yeah, and I'm sure you've probably heard a lot from our people, but we had the biggest and best launch class of corn and soybean varieties that we've had in the last 20 years of Syngenta Seeds. The research and product development that started in 2018 is now, corn is a 7-year cycle, they like to say. That's really starting to come through for farmers in North America, and we're excited about that. We're excited about being able to provide a choice of high-yielding soybean genetics to farmers in both the ExtendFlex package and the Enlist E3 package. We're one of the only companies that can do that for farmers, and that's really important given some of the recent legislation that's happened in court rulings, not knowing exactly what herbicide options are going to be available for farmers. We can be, the partner of choice for farmers.
Well, Eric, it's great to see you and visit with you here. We're at the 2024 Commodity Classic. I'm Chuck Zimmerman reporting.
You're listening to the Agnet NewsHour. Now for more news, Markets paid close attention to the soybean demand numbers in the February WASDE report. Chad Smith has the details.
USDA released its February World Agricultural Supply and Demand Estimates report. Mac Marshall, Vice President of Market Intelligence for the United Soybean Board, said he was watching South America's crop estimate.
Brazilian harvest is continuing along at a pretty nice clip, ahead of the five-year pace, definitely ahead of last year. Brazilian soybeans were cut from 157 million metric tons to 156. USDA has issued a couple consecutive months of cuts. I think it's worth noting that local market observers, including Conabe in Brazil, have the estimates still lower. Most important to remember is that Argentina has come back really significantly relative to last year's trying crop down there. So there's a large supply in aggregate coming out of South America.
The report predicts less international demand for soybeans.
On the international side, definitely something's weighing on the markets. And then domestically, it's February. There's not a crop in the ground for beans. The focus is really on demand side adjustments on the domestic balance sheet. And what we saw there was a 35 million bushel decrease in the export forecast for this year.
The good news is domestic demand for soybeans will continue growing in 2024.
Let's also remember what's unfolding here domestically, which I think is just as important as anything else. We're exporting fewer whole beans because we're crushing a lot more domestically. We've got four straight months of record crush for each of those months since the start of the meal and oil marketing year on October 1. There are more plants coming online later this year. So that crush number domestically, I think, is going to continue to stay strong and continue to grow. So even as we see that export number come back a little bit on whole beans, let's remember that we're crushing a lot of meal and on pace for record meal exports this year on the heels of a new record last year.
Keep up with the latest news from the United Soybean Board at unitedsoybean.org. And Wednesday mornings at 10 a.m. Eastern, 9 a.m. Central on RFD-TV. Chad Smith reporting.
USDA's end of February State Stories report provides a look at mostly improving winter wheat crop conditions over the course of the season. Here's Rod Bain with more.
What does winter wheat crop conditions look like as a whole among states reporting to USDA this time of year? USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey says within the end of February edition of the Agriculture Department State Stories report,
the good news for winter wheat is that we have had a relatively easy winter. The crop, generally speaking, has seen improved moisture since planting. And other than a cold outbreak that hit in mid-January, we have escaped significant weather challenges that could have hurt the crop.
Yet, what does that mean on a state level?
Conditions in our number one production state improving. Kansas, which went into this winter, which is 32% of the winter wheat rated in good to excellent condition, has seen improvements each month and now coming in at 57% good to excellent. At the same time, Kansas wheat rated very poor to poor was 32% near the end of November. That has since dropped to 13%.
Rippey adds similar condition trend improvements are noted for winter wheat throughout the winter in the Great Plains and Midwest.
We have a long list of states where the winter wheat is rated at least two-thirds good to excellent. Just going alphabetically through those, we have California, as well as Indiana, Missouri, North Carolina, Ohio, Oklahoma, all making that list of at least two-thirds good to excellent.
Meanwhile,
we only have two of our reporting states with double digits in the very poor-to-poor categories as of February 25th. That is Kansas at 13%. The other state in double digits at this time is Texas, 19% very poor to poor.
So Rippey summarizes the winter wheat crop outlook via reporting states in the February State Stories edition.
A pretty optimistic look at the winter wheat situation as we head into spring, with only about 1/8 of the U.S. production area currently experiencing drought, down from nearly half of the crop at planting.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
That's today's top agriculture news. I'm Sabrina Halverson. Thank you for sharing your morning with us.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Brian German and Sabrina Halverson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.